Jan Ervin's been with us before. We had Jan on, maybe 4 months ago. Last time we got together, we were talking about the duality of Christianity and shamanism. But it one step, and this is sort of the other half of the shoe, as they say, they're the foot that drops the shoe, is that there was, after all, a certain pharmacopoeia that went with this sort of thing. That is sacred plants. Today, of course, you know, you can get arrested for using a plant, something that is grown in nature, by nature, for nature, and if you wish, by God, for God. But now they're illegal. I keep thinking, you know, are you going to bust God?
Yeah, well, you know, and in fact, Amsterdam is in the process right now, or Holland is in the process right now of trying to criminalize magic mushrooms. And
why?
Well, because some 17-year-old girl jumped off a bridge, but you know they don't care that 200 people a night do the same thing with alcohol. But if one person in a year does something stupid with entheogens, they rush to outlaw it. So,
well, that's a stupid concept because it's not going to keep people from jumping off bridges.
Of course not. Nor will it keep anybody from getting a hold of the mushrooms.
Yeah, this is the other thing is that there has been this pharmacopoeia of natural, as you call it, entheogenic substances. Break down that word so we can understand it in English, entheogenic. Well, we understand genic.
Yeah, well, the word entheogen was first developed by Professor Carl Ruck of Boston University and Jonathan Ott and Gordon Wasson. And basically what it breaks down to is N is within, Theo is God, and Gen is to generate. So there are basically plants, fungi, and other substances that help facilitate or generate the God within us and help us basically experience things that we normally wouldn't experience. They're sort of a separate class of drugs that have a different effect on the chemistry of the mind than, say, things like opium or aspirin, or even, you know, cannabis can have those effects in very high doses, especially when eaten. But what these things do is they basically destroy is probably not the proper word. They make vanish, or they disappear you into another dimension if taken properly in the right set and setting. Now, taking these substances and going to a party with kids and loud music and stuff probably wouldn't facilitate that type of experience. They're typically taken in dark settings of no noise and no light and no distractions and things like that to bring on the entheogenic experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're familiar with stories of, like, for instance, you know, Tales of Don Juan by Carlos Castaneda. I'm sure you read Castaneda.
Yeah, I've read his books a couple of times.
I take a large amount of skepticism when I hear that answer, though.
Yeah, Carlos Castaneda is pretty much known as one of the charlatans in the entire field of study.
I think it's interesting. I mean, he created Don Juan. Now, whether or not Don Juan was real or not, I mean, there were certain things about Don Juan's work, or the character Don Juan, if you will, that opened up a whole area of interest to a generation about these entheogenic substances.
Yeah, there's a book written called something about psychedelic substances psychedelics and 60s opportunism that was written about Carlos Castaneda and the whole Don Juan thing being a scam. And even his wife came out against him after he died and said that he had made the whole thing up.
But, you know, nevertheless, though, he opened up a whole area of interest, if not study, based upon his work. You know, I know a lot...
Yes and no. I mean, the field was already there. He basically stole a lot of his concepts from Gordon Wasson, who popularized the Mexican mushroom cult from Oaxaca, the Mazatec Indian cult down there in Maria Sabina. It was Gordon Wasson who really popularized the entire field of the mushrooms and things like that in Life magazine, and sort of started the whole 60s psychedelic revolution with that article. And then Carlos Castaneda just capitalized on it for his thesis.
Yeah. Well, I remember reading it, you know, particularly the first two, and that was in the Journey to Ixtlan, I think it was number four.
Journey to Ixtlan was probably number seven.
No, that far along the line. Well, the guy did a good job. I mean, he made a decent living at it.
I've got nine or ten of his books sitting on the bookshelf right here next to me.
Well, but they were fun to read, especially the first one. You know, the stories of Don Juan and about how Don Juan being a brujo, or, you know, effectively a shaman. But that's what we're talking about. We're talking about shaman and shamanism as being a very old, and by the way, in when we speak of shamanism, we also talk about the use of these substances. Why were these sacred plants not only taboo, but attributed to witchcraft and eventually made illegal by what you call the pharmacocracy?
Well, originally, the shaman, medicine men, priests were inseparable. And if we go far enough back, even into Western religious history, if we study the Essenes at Qumran were known as the therapeutai, or the physicians, and they were a religious order, a Jewish religious order that lived on the edge of the Dead Sea, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And they had a record of both using, that appears to have been using these substances by their very name, the physicians, and some of their rituals that were combined in that as well. And if we move forward from there, we can sort of see a line of the use of these substances up to at least about 1300, roughly thereabout, with the Knights of Malta returning from the Crusades, and they stopped in an area in France called Plaincourt, France, and they established a church there, and they painted the fresco of Adam and Eve on the wall depicting the Tree of Knowledge as the Amanita muscaria mushroom, which was for many years highly debated, and myself and Mike Hoffman and Professor Carl Ruck and another doctor in Italy, Giorgio Samarini, we've all written articles that completely debased the argument proposed by Erwin Panofsky against the Plaincourt as mushroom theory or obviousness. And from there, it sort of ends up in a sort of bouncy legality issue. Well, it really falls out of sight from there, actually, until about the turn of this century or middle of the 1800s, the Alice in Wonderland stories and things like that. And then it appears in 1957 with Gordon Wasson once again going to Mexico and discovering the mushroom cult down in Oaxaca. And then in the 1960s, it blows up with Timothy Leary. And we can pretty much blame or point the finger toward, I don't like to use the word blame, Timothy Leary for giving the entire entheogen community such a bad reputation and causing so much hysteria that it caused its outlaw. But, you know, once again, the laws are based on double standards. You know, if you look at the dangers of cigarettes and alcohol and coffee, and, you know, the record of entheogens for safety is so far better. You know, if you have globally one or two, maybe three deaths a year reported to all entheogens globally compared to 150 to 200,000 deaths in the U.S. to alcohol alone. So, to make a long story short, or at least kind of short, that's about it.
It went through a process there. You know, you talk about the Knights of Malta. And I don't know, are they, you know, the church cracked down on these people rather severely.
Yeah. Well, certainly. Well, see, what they did, and they're within the church, it appears that they used them themselves, and that's kind of the angle I was just going from. But if we look at them from the quote-unquote pagan cultures, and the word pagan just means rural, the country people.
Right.
It comes from the Latin root paganus. And so the pagan cultures were using these substances. They also maintained the knowledge of the astrotheology, which the church had forbidden the common people to know, because if you could understand what astrotheology was, if you understood the motions of the stars and the moon and the sun, you would obviously be able to unravel the major portions of religion itself. But from about 1100 forward up until 1600s in Europe, late 1600s, and then the 1700s in South America and the U.S., the church and then the Spanish Inquisitions over here basically went around and killed all of these so-called pagan cultures and people that practiced these religions. The Native Americans with peyote, the Maya used many different substances in South America. The Inca used cacti, and they used ayahuasca and many different substances. And what's interesting is if you look at the religions from both sides of the planet, they're almost identical. The Maya religion, although they had a little bit more human sacrifice going on at a later time than as our culture did, but the religious symbolism and practices and rituals and things like that regarding both cultures is very, very similar. The Maya had Teonanacatl, which was their mushroom god, which literally translates into the flesh of God, and they would eat their flesh of God. And we have the Eucharist, mm-hmm. and the Eucharist is God's flesh. You know, you bring God within you. So you know, and then you have Theogen. You know, the God is generated within you. So. Bringing us full circle, and a lot of people like to bring up the argument of John Allegro, who was the first to propose that in Theogens and Christianity, that in Theogens existed in Christianity, his book in 1970, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, and he was largely marginalized, and I've done a lot of research onto the arguments against him, and we just recently finished two articles that are being published in the Journal of Higher Criticism here shortly. At least one of them is in print this month, and another one hopefully early next year. Looking at reanalyzing all the arguments for and against John Allegro's research and showing how he was falsely attacked by academia at whole, who refused to even read the footnotes and references in his book, and even scholars in the field like Gordon Wasson attacked John Allegro's research. And when we went back through and analyzed the basis of the attacks, they're completely unfounded and based purely in Wasson's own self-benefit to protect his own theory. So those are some things that have just turned up in the last 2 months or so in the most recent research that we've been doing, myself and especially Michael Hoffman of egodeath.com.
All right, we're going to take a break here, Jan, if you will, and hold on a second. We'll pick it up where we left off, and how we're going to talk about the other half of your presentation, about the big pharma being the new inquisitors, the persecutors. You know, I guess now instead of putting them at the stake, we send them to court. Which is,
yeah, we do.
I think I'd rather burn. Anyway, hold on a second. Jan Urban with us, the Pharmacratic Inquisition. Back again with my guest. We're talking again with Jan Urban, his latest work, the Pharmacratic Inquisition. Let's talk about this Inquisition by the big pharma folk. Who are they? Why are they doing what they're doing? I think money has more to do with it than anything. But explain this full range of their thought process and why we seem to allow it.
You know, let me step back for a second and correct you on something. The Pharmacratic Inquisition 2007 is a brand-new DVD that we've just released. It's a companion for a book that we released last year. So just wanted to get that straightened out. As far as the Pharmacratic Inquisition, we can trace elements of the suppression. I'm not sure which direction you're going. Are you talking about the current war on drugs, or which direction did you want to take that?
I'd like to take yours.
You'd like to take mine, okay. Well, from what we can tell from the research, and it looks like it starts with the discovery of the Book of Law, the Book of Deuteronomy, about 665 BCE, and that seems to be about the first time that the use of entheogenic substances appears to be banned. And then we already talked about the Inquisitions taking it up to the 1600s and then 1700s. And then if we start from the modern-day war on drugs, we can pick that up from about 1937 with the Marijuana Tax Act that was passed by the U.S. government to outlaw the production of cannabis hemp as an industrial crop and mainstay. And the outlawing of hemp and marijuana itself is a direct attack on the freedom of religion. Even today in India, the Hindu religion, the sacred drink bang or bhang is based on cannabis, and bhang or bong is their word for cannabis or marijuana. So that's where we first see the suppression of marijuana. What's interesting is in 1937, when we look at the hearings for the Marijuana Tax Act, the American Medical Association actually came out against the outline of it because they argued at the time that about 20% of all medications were made from marijuana, and this is in 1937. So, you know, they didn't want so many of their medications banned. But as we move forward from there, it And what happens is we have this switch to where only single chemical compounds can be patented and therefore approved by the FDA as drugs to be able to be prescribed by doctors. Anything that cannot be patented, therefore, cannot be approved by the FDA and therefore is unsafe for human consumption by their logic. And that's why they've tried to ban vitamins and herbs and so many things like that. But marijuana and these other substances also fall into that category. And the looking historically back, the symbol of the caduceus, which is the staff with the two serpents with the wings on top that you see on hospitals and ambulance and things like that, that's an ancient symbol for both money and for drugs and for the trade of drugs. Caesar Nero had the symbol on the back of his coins. We find it in the dividend office of England. Andy and I argue in our book that the symbol is the symbol for the U.S. dollar. And it's this symbol has always represented the trade of drugs and herbs and spices and things like that, which were some of the most highly sought after substances in ancient times. But with the corporate modernization of drugs and the making it illegal, literally, for you to cure yourself by using the plants and drugs and herbs that you see fit for your own body, you know, and there is some protection there. It's to protect us from
ourselves,
from charlatans and dangerous substances.
Oh.
At the same time, well, and from ourselves, but at the same time, you know, it's like we have to learn to take responsibility for our actions too. We need to learn not to, the government isn't supposed to be our mommy and daddy, especially not in a free country. You're either free or you're not free. There's no gray area. It's sort of like being pregnant, you know?
Well, how is it then that the world of the big pharma, which is an industry, in other words, big business, effectively has become the persecutor rather than the government?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by them being the persecutors.
Well, who's responsible for these laws? Who's responsible for cracking down on what the FDA can't control?
Well, yeah, I guess in that regard you're right, because you have the pharmaceutical lobbyists who get in there, and well, not only do they get their top people into the FDA to approve their drugs, but they also lobby and fund certain drugs to be passed and things like that. So I guess in that regard you are correct that it is certainly the big pharmaceutical companies that are behind a lot of that stuff. You know, speaking of cannabis specifically, cannabis has been shown to be effective for 20 to effective for replacing 20 to 40% of all medications in use today. You know, for glaucoma, for migraine headaches and PMS and cancer, glaucoma, you know, there's so many different things, pain relief, analgesics and whatnot. So it's definitely a threat to the interests of corporate profits as well as herbs and other things. And just recently there's been several studies done on psilocybin mushrooms showing medical and health benefits for those as well. And then in the 1960s, studies were done on LSD that showed tremendous benefit from taking LSD in the proper setting and curing people of different skin problems. And while the numbers were misrepresented, we do know that for instance, people that were locked in jail for long-term prison sentences had a dramatic turnaround when they were taken through the full-blown psychedelic experience with a professional. So with the privatization of prisons and the CIA and everybody else making money off of the illegal drug trade, like we remember from Iran-Contra and MENA Arkansas and the whole Barry Seal scandal and all of that stuff with George Bush and Bill Clinton involved in that whole fiasco. You know, it all sort of ties together. And then you had the Air America with them smuggling heroin from Laos and Cambodia. So, you know, they're sort of a double standard where they're making money off of it being illegal while selling it themselves. They're using black markets.
Well, that would, I mean, from a purely capitalistic point of view, what an ideal situation. It's like Philip Morris.
It's the Ouroboros feeding itself, and it's itself alive by their lies and manipulation of the facts and, you know, locking people up for what are known as consensual crimes, you know, which is one thing that Europe has a much better understanding than the U.S. does, is the Europeans prosecute consensual crimes much less than Americans. Consensual crimes are things that adults choose to do between themselves, like I think some 30 states have oral sex illegal in the U.S.
I always wonder about the people, some of those lawmakers that make those laws, and you find out what they're really up to.
Well, yeah, you know, and every week you hear of some new Republican politician getting busted in some sex scandal. So.
Yeah, go of all the people, at least Bill Clinton wouldn't have made a law about consensual sex. They're not. Hold on a second, Jan. We're going to take a break here. 303-713-8585. James in San Francisco. James, when we come back, we'll go right to it as we continue on News Radio 850 KOA. 385-85, the number. We're talking with Jan Ervin and his book, or actually, it's a DVD. We should make that perfectly clear. The Pharmacratic Inquisition 2007 DVD, which is a follow-on to his earlier book about astrotheology and shamanism. We continue. Let's go to San Francisco. James, you're on with Jan Ervin. Good morning.
Greetings.
Hi.
Hello. I'm reading a fascinating book right now on the history of Esalen and some of the cast of characters, most notably Aldous Huxley, Christopher Isherwood, and then later on Terence McKenna, who I'm reading an amazing book, Food of the Gods. What do you think of Terence McKenna's work? I know he's died a number of years ago. He had a brain disorder, but it seems to me, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm a fan of Terence's work to an point. I think his research is fantastic for the most part, and he was certainly a genius and a pioneer. But he certainly had many errors, and one of the things that he argues in Food of the Gods that we attack in our book is he argues against Amanita muscaria as a candidate for soma because he ate 5 grams raw, which he only did once, and then threw up, and that was his sole test run with Amanita muscaria. And you know, we know today that they're dried and you're supposed to increase your dose every couple of hours as you go until you reach a certain state, and there's certain things that you can do to get rid of the nausea and things. But overall, Terence, I think, was definitely a genius, and I certainly was a big fan of his work. In fact, if you go online, I released about 70 hours worth of Terence's talks and interviews on MP3. So most of the audio files that you find online, I actually released.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for that.
All right.
You're welcome.
And Jan, can you go low to the top of the news?
Sure.
Okay, stay there, please. We'll pick it up where we left off. We're talking about his new DVD called The Pharmacratic Inquisition. Who are these pharmocrats? We continue. You're listening to News Radio 850 KOA. Let's get right back to the telephone. We're talking with Jan Ervin, The Pharmacratic Inquisition 2007, a DVD, a follow-on to his book, Astrotheology and Shamanism. If we take a look at these pharmacrats, and that's what you call them, pharmacrats.
The drug rulers, yes.
Yeah. Now, how is it they wield so much power?
Well, it's basically, as you know, you can't use the drugs, you can't go into pharmacy and treat yourself, you have to go to a doctor who bears the sign of the caduceus in order to have him give you the certain drugs for you to cure yourself. Like I said, the FDA refuses to approve things that are not single chemical compounds, and only those things that are that can be patented. So anything that's a plant or herbal or whatever it may be that falls outside of a single chemical compound is not used and is looked on as pseudoscience or not sound medical science. And, dozens of studies have been performed on cannabis all over the world, is one example, showing the efficacy of cannabis as medicine. but the FDA still refuses its own findings and the U.S. government findings that it does indeed have medical values. So things like this and the overall control and outlaw of drugs and the jailing of people who use what they choose to in their own body that's not the typical alcohol, sugar, tobacco, and television drugs, anything that's outside of that is basically considered taboo and demonized. And every culture basically has different substances that are taboo and demonized. Every century or so they change, but for the last century the United States has been the largest force in a global negative attitude towards psychoactive substances. So today the U.S. and the war on drugs is really the leader in the suppression of religious freedom and human rights to be able to use what you want to is, you know, in your own home. A great book on that topic was written by a guy named Peter McWilliams, who in fact was killed over medical marijuana by the federal government because he had cancer and was using it to help treat himself, and they decided that they were not going to allow him legally under California Prop 215 to use medical marijuana. So they started drug testing him once a week, and he died from asphyxiation from vomit in his bathroom, unable to smoke a joint to stop the nausea that he was given medical marijuana in the first place for. So this is the kind of absurd pharmacratic or drug ruling inquisition, and these are the drug rulers, the Barry McCaffreys and the drug czars and the presidents and these people that continue to push this stuff and continue the propaganda line. That's the pharmacratic inquisition. And people like us who study and practice shamanism are, while we're told that we're supposed to have freedom of religion in the United States, as any Native American can tell you, with the practice of peyote, they had to fight many, many, many decades to get the Supreme Court to finally approve their ancient religion that they were doing thousands of years before white man ever came to this continent. So that's the conundrum that we're in.
Well, I mean, as you say, that because it's not controllable by the FDA and the Food and Drug Administration, I have to wonder sometimes that the presumption was their rationale was to be able to make sure that it was an outgrowth of what was called the Pure Food and Drug Act.
Right.
And I think it was 1937 or something. It seems to me...
The same year marijuana was outlawed. Go figure.
Go figure indeed. I mean, wasn't that their purpose, though? I mean, to make sure that the food and the drugs that people were getting was pure.
Sure, that's the purpose, but at the same time, then all they're doing is they're putting all the profits in the hands of their buddies and the big pharmaceutical companies. But, you know, back then there was a problem of charlatans selling snake oil medicines and things like that, but at the same time, a lot of those medicines were valid. It's rather unfortunate that, you know, we're considered as children and not allowed to determine what is right for our own bodies. I mean, if you could imagine something like eating at McDonald's is far worse than smoking marijuana or taking psychedelic mushrooms or even LSD. These things are far safer than eating, you know, as this guy showed in Supersize Me, if you eat McDonald's for 30 days, you're going to die. Well, guess what? If you smoke pot every day for 30 days, U.S. studies in Costa Rica and Jamaica in the 1970s showed people who smoked an ounce of marijuana a day for 5 years or more showed no cognitive function disabilities whatsoever.
Yeah, but they don't want to hear that, obviously.
Well, of course not. You know, so there are these double standards where we lock people in jail for marijuana, and the U.S. is the number one jailer in the world. We jail 25% of the world's entire prison population, and most of those are in prison. About 60% of those are in prison for nonviolent drug offenses. And about 40 to 50% of those are in prison for simple marijuana possession. So we're talking about locking up people for a flower, you know, that's basically as benign as a rose. A rose has thorns. It can jab your thumb, but you don't go to prison for it. That's basically about the biggest risk that's ever been proven from cannabis is bronchitis. And there are zero deaths in history to relate it to the plant directly. You know, granted there might be car accidents and things, but marijuana does not affect the balance centers of the brain like alcohol does, so you don't lose your balance, and therefore what's interesting on the same point is the profile for the California Highway Patrol to find marijuana users is to look for people that are actually, in fact, perfect drivers. So, you know,
what? Wait. Back up on that one. Perfect drivers?
Yeah.
That's their profile?
The profile for somebody under the influence of marijuana is that they do not break any laws.
Really?
Really.
How do you come by that? I mean, how do you know that?
Well, I used to carry the law statute in my wallet for years on the study that was done for. But that was very common knowledge for a long time in the 90s when I was working with the Drug Reform Coordination Network. That was one of the studies or one of the profiles that were standard use, and they claim not to use a lot of these profiles anymore, but you know that they still do. And, so, you know, if you're driving 55 miles an hour and you're not breaking any laws and you're turning and signaling perfectly and doing all of that stuff, they basically consider that you're probably paranoid and smoking pot. Well, I wanted to mention real quick, if you don't mind, a website for our book and video. And people can also watch our video for free on our website if they'd like as well.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
And the website is Gnostic, Gnostic, media.com. That's all one word, Gnosticmedia.com.
Gnosticmedia.com. All right, very good. And we have people on the line that want to join with as we take a quick break. We'll do just that. We're talking with Jan Irvin, the Pharmacratic Inquisition, a DVD. We continue back again with Jan Irvin, his book, his new CD, a follow-on to his book, Astrotheology and Shamanism. This one called The Pharmacratic Inquisition 2007, which is in a DVD. And you have a website, it's what again?
Gnostic Media, Gnostic Media. And it's actually a DVD, not a CD.
I'm sorry, did I say CD?
You did.
I apologize.
Oh, we'll get it right. That's all right.
Yeah,
all
right. DVD. I'll even circle and underline it and put it in red. let's go to Longmont, Pat. Hey, Pat, you're on with Jan Irvin. Good morning.
Morning, fellas.
Hi.
Hey, listen, Rick, imagine it's a nice day and you want to take a motorcycle ride, right?
Yeah.
So I show up at my Harley and I tell you I just had a nice Big Mac with some fries and a Coke.
Uh-huh.
And 7-Eleven Greg shows up on his Honda and he tells you he just dropped some acid, right?
And why would he do that?
Well, I'm setting up.
Well, you know, you realize, no, yeah, but what you're also doing is not only taking a shot at Greg. I don't know, why do you hate him so much?
I'm just jive. Come on, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but you pulled this chain long enough, you ran out of chain.
Well, listen, whose bike are you going to jump on?
Mine.
I'm saying you're not going to jump on Greg's bike, right?
Unless I drive.
Well, there, right.
How about this? We don't drive under the intoxicated under the influence of anything.
Well, yeah, see, the thing is, Pat doesn't believe that.
Well, look, here's the point.
No, Pat, do you believe that?
Yeah.
That people wouldn't drive intoxicated?
No, they would.
Now, how do you know this?
Well, here's the point I'm making.
No, come on, Pat. You've got to be able to make a clear case before you can make your final argument. Okay. What makes you say that people would drive intoxicated?
Because people do.
Under the influence of...
I'm assuming that his argument is that's going to alter somehow with or without the legality of certain substances. And obviously, you know, anything, if people... you know, and I already mentioned Peter McWilliams' book. If you threaten other people by driving unsafely, then you should be, you know, arrested, and that's one issue. If you're sitting in your living room and doing these things on your own time, that's another issue. You know, specifically was cannabis, though, earlier.
Yeah, but he's, in this case, let's say it's acid. The presumption is, of course, therefore one would be driving. I think the question about whether or not to drive under the influence, whether it be the under influence of alcohol or LSD or cannabis, the fact is driving under the influence is just dumber in a box of rocks.
Absolutely. Of course it is.
Yeah.
You know, if I had to choose one of those three, obviously I would choose cannabis. If I had to choose two, I would pick cannabis and LSD. You know, 80% of all fatal highway accidents are with alcohol, which is something that is legal.
But my point, Jan, is this, and I'm being serious about this. In other words, we have a problem in this country with people drinking and driving. And people are stupid. And no matter how much you try and tell them not to drink and drive, they're going to. So
right.
because alcohol is legal and it's easy to get and it's at every party, people are going to do more stupid things on alcohol. Now, if you legalize to any extent LSD or even pot or anything else, it will automatically increase the number of people who do stupid things while they're high.
I completely disagree. That sort of rhetoric was debunked in the 90s. Trying to say that highway accidents may go up because something is legal or illegal. 25% of the population uses cannabis today, right now.
In their basement,
okay? And yes. We don't see the fatal accidents and things like that for it.
Because they stay in their basements, Jan.
But what we do see is 857,000 people being arrested and locked up every single year for a benign substance. Now, if they are arrested and jailed for driving under the influence, for causing danger to somebody else, that is one thing. But, if alcohol is causing 80% of the fatal accidents out there, and marijuana is causing maybe 1%, why aren't you attacking alcohol? Why aren't you saying, well, hey, let's reanalyze things that are going to be safer instead of saying, well, we should keep them illegal because somebody might? That's, in a free country, that sort of logic just does not fly.
Well, what about the nation of a nanny state? I mean, that is what we're dealing with here. The state knows best. They know what's good for you and what you should or shouldn't take. Pat, you don't believe in nannyism, do you?
I don't.
All right.
Absolutely. But here's my problem, Jan, and I am totally to each his own. I really believe that. I really do. But my point is this. Just as a person living in society with a small child, another one on the way, I got to worry about...
I have children, too, so you're no exception to the rule here.
Absolutely not. But what I'm saying is, can you deny, in other words, if there are going to be more people smoking pot because it's legal, don't you think more people will do it if it's legal?
Well, if you actually study the facts, countries like Holland have actually had a 50% drop in the use of cannabis since it's been legal, because kids who like to use substances because they're rebelling against society, well, if you legalize those substances, well, guess what? Kids don't like to use them to rebel, so actually... use in society drops as a whole. So, you would see an increase for the first year, maybe year and a half, but after
Rick,
that,
you
would actually
that?
See a dramatic drop.
Rick, do you believe that?
What about that? By the rebellious notion?
No, that if we legalize it, less people will use it in the long run.
Well, the ones that are going to use it.
That's actually been proven in every country that has legalized these substances.
I'm talking about
already.
Tiny countries, tiny little countries. I'm talking about the United States. Can you imagine it being legal?
What difference does it matter the size of the country?
More people.
Percentile is percentile, though.
But so what? You're talking about, in Holland alone, there's, 25, 30 million people?
Yeah, in Holland alone, probably one out of every 25 people has a car. Here, everybody's got a car. I mean, it's just a different world.
Okay, in New York, most people don't drive their own cars, so therefore, by your rhetoric, we should legalize it in New York, correct? But I recommend you read a very good book. It's called Ain't Nobody's Business If You Do. The Absurdity of Consensual Crimes in Our Free Country. And the author, Peter McWilliams, breaks down your argument step by step. And as well, there's an organization online called the Drug Reform Coordination Network, or DRCNet. They also go by their website as Stop the Drug War. And they have every study, every CHP study, every breakdown of the influence of each drug on driving and things like that, broken down in all of these different studies and the true impact. So, instead of making these broad brush generalizations, I suggest you're actually looking at the studies and looking point by point, breaking it down. Instead of saying it's okay to put in almost 1 million people in prison a year for possessing a flower, a plant, something that grows from earth naturally, something that was required by law for the defense of this country, the hemp plant. People who had ill intentions, who intentionally outlawed this stuff and have made huge profits on it, you're suggesting that sort of corrupt behavior should continue. We should continue to lock up innocent people and destroy families. You want to talk about family values and protecting children. What about the 1 million people every year that are going to lose their families because they get busted for a joint?
Yeah, but I got to tell you, Jan, you're going to have a tough boat you're rowing there, because most of us feel in our guts that you make this stuff legal, you're just going to add to the problem we have now.
Actually, 60 or 70% of the populace is now against the war on drugs and for legalization. You're actually one of the few people who's still holding out who hasn't looked at the studies and the information that's available out there today.
Well, considering only a few states have made minor small possession somewhat legal, I tend to disagree with you. I understand your point, and like I said, I agree with to each his own. I really do, but I just, you've got another
so
problem.
Logic, something that is safer than alcohol, that doesn't affect the balance centers of the brain, that has been, you know, California Highway Patrol has done studies that show that people under the influence of marijuana are almost identical, almost as safe as drivers not under the influence of anything. And therefore, your logic is we should keep putting those people in prison for something that's benign, for something that does not have as high a risk as alcohol of putting other people in jeopardy on the road. But we should still keep it illegal in some sort of backward, twisted logic.
Well, I've seen people on shrooms, and I've seen people on LSD, and I've got it. Maybe I agree with you on as far as cannabis.
I'm not saying everybody should go out and drive on this stuff.
But they
if
will.
You can't do
they
things
will,
responsibly,
Jan.
You should suffer the consequences.
But here's
if
my
somebody
point.
Goes out and puts other people in jeopardy, they suffer the consequences,
they,
period.
They will.
Freedom, there's an old saying, my freedom ends where your nose begins. If I impact your freedom, your livelihood, things like that, then I've committed a crime. Stop putting people in jail for crimes that have never been committed, for victimless crimes.
Well, I see it as sort of the dike holding back the flood, because the problem is, even though it might be okay to legalize it to a small extent, people will want more and more. And
that's ridiculous arguments. Like I said, every single country, every single study that's looked at these things has proven the opposite of everything you're suggesting. You're regurgitating old 90s drug war propaganda that just does not hold up to scientific scrutiny.
So I went to college with people who did shrooms, LSD, and pot and everything else, and alcohol, and I saw the differences in the way people behave.
And tell me, straight up,
yeah.
who caused more accidents, who committed more crimes? If you went to a party with pot smokers versus alcoholics, where were the fights?
Well, absolutely with the alcohol, yeah. There's no doubt about it.
Of course. So we're going to keep locking pot up because of that twisted logic? Come on.
No, my point is this. You're missing my point. The numbers
you're missing my points. I've already covered your points, and I've given you references to look into.
Well, I agree with you as far as the effects, okay? But the problem is when you increase the number of people who are going to be on these different drugs, you're going to increase the number of stupid people who get into cars and
I disagree. I think if you stop lying about these substances and stop telling people that marijuana is as dangerous as methamphetamine and heroin, then you'll probably be able to properly educate these people and tell people logically, reasonably, what the facts are, what the risks are, and how and to approach these things as adults instead of little children. Your philosophy, you want to treat everybody as small children, and my philosophy is, hey, let's be open, let's be honest, let's look at the facts, let's look at the strengths, the weaknesses, the risks, the benefits, and let's move forward logically step by step, not these broad-brushed programs that have been going on since the 1930s that have failed year in and year out. And we're spending billions of dollars every year on this war on drugs that has failed year in and year out. Every day in the press, I see newspapers writing about the failed war on drugs, but yet it goes on. You know, let's save our tax money. Let people go back to their families for growing a plant, you know.
Well, the problem is how many plants become one plant. You know what I'm saying? How many? Are you advocating just personal use, or you're talking about if a guy wants to grow 100 plants and supply his friends?
I think it should be legal. So what if it's 1 or 100 plants? Who are you to decide? Isn't, you know, in a capitalist free market system, shouldn't the market decide what use is and what isn't? That's why drug prohibition doesn't work. The market decides. We have, you know, the war on terrorism. The borders are locked down, and yet cocaine is still pouring through the borders. You know, it's Ricky Ross and the CIA importation scandal all over again. You have to end the prohibition to pull it back around.
All right, I've got to actually pull it back around to a commercial break here, Pat, and we've got to take off. I'll talk to you later. And we'll take that break. We continue. Jan Ervin with us, The Pharmacratic Inquisition, a DVD. Available, by the way, a follow-on to the Astrotheology and Shamanism book as we continue on News Radio 850 KOA. Jan Ervin with us, The Pharmacratic Inquisition, nannyism at its worst with a bite of the law. I suppose this is the problem, isn't it? It's so easy to rationalize why the government is right. How is that so, though? I mean, as a nation, we don't trust our government, and for good reason, I may add. And yet, when it comes to this, everybody says, oh, yeah, that's right. And, you know, look what happened. All I can think of, isn't this the same argumentation that filtered through the population during the age of prohibition of alcohol?
Absolutely. You know, and there's the old saying, the definition of insanity is repeating the same thing over and over and expecting new results. And I think it was Benjamin Franklin who said, they who would give up an ounce of liberty for security deserve neither liberty or security.
Yeah, and we'll get neither, and anyway.
And we'll get neither.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes, one of my favorite people. 303-713-8585, the number. Let's continue on the telephone. Kendall out there somewhere. Kendall, you're on with Jan Ervin. Good morning.
Hello, Rick.
Hey.
I was wondering, when he said that potheads are better drivers, does he really want all truck drivers to be stoned?
I think we were very clear about not driving under the influence of anything. But what we
I see that all the time. What people don't realize is, when I'm driving a truck, I can look down the car and see what they're doing. You see that a lot. And trust me, they're not better drivers.
Okay, well, you know, what we specifically stated was that if you compare marijuana to the California Highway Patrol studies showed that marijuana users were almost identical to those users under the influence of nothing. Now, in as far as response times and things like that, I never said that, you know, people should drive under the influence of anything. I very clearly stated against that. What we specifically mentioned was the studies show that the punishment does not justify the crime. Okay,
well, you actually, have I could make the case that marijuana is probably one of the most dangerous drugs to society out there.
How do you
figure that?
Easy. You say, like, you use the example, like, you never see two potheads fighting.
Yeah.
And when's the last time have you ever seen an ambitious pothead? Most of the potheads I've ever met, the most they want to do is work just enough to get by and then go back down to their basement for pot.
Well, that's funny, because there was actually some very good research about that was put out, and the U.S. government did a study on that in the 90s that showed if you were to smoke marijuana once in your life and quit, you were far less likely to be successful. But what the same study also showed was that if you didn't quit, you were far more likely to be successful. And in fact, most marijuana smokers are middle and upper class white males. So, you know, just because the people that you know happen to be lazy pot smokers, it doesn't mean that you can't have, you know, those people are probably going to be lazy anyway. You know, you can have people who are lazy alcoholics. You know, marijuana in and of itself doesn't make you lazy.
Well, most of them I met, they're pretty lazy. I mean, that's most they want to do. They just want to get stoned.
What do you mean by most? You know, most people that I know that smoke marijuana hold down full-time jobs and make anywhere from $60,000 to $200,000-$300,000 a year. So, you know, it depends on what most you're talking about. But I recommend you read a book called Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts by Dr. Lynn Zimmer and Dr. John Morgan. And that goes into the exact studies that I just referred to and about the inaccuracy of your statements.
What about the hallucinogens? You said they should be legal too?
I think all substances should be legal.
Okay, I knew a guy that did an awful lot of acid and then he quit. And then years after he quit doing acid, he had another trip just right out of the blue. Do you really want people running around seeing pink butterflies flying down the road?
Pink butterflies flying down the road. Have you ever done an entheogen yourself or anything, or are you just
using
speculative?
No, absolutely not. That's what happened to him. He had a pretty major trip years after he quit.
Are you aware that the natural chemistry of the brain contains DMT, which is the most powerful psychedelic substance on Earth? That is in your brain right at this very second. When you go to sleep at night, when you enter into dream world.
They do change the chemical makeup of your brain.
Well, you know, it's a fungus, but we can't be outlined what you don't like. How many people are going to go out and drink alcohol? Do you think alcohol should be outlawed tomorrow?
Well, I think alcohol, well, that didn't work too good the first time, but...
Kendall, his question was a valid one, requires to be answered. Do you think it should be illegal, alcohol?
He's convinced me. All the trouble he's brought up with alcohol, probably.
Ah,
well,
so we should bring
that problem.
He's convinced me. I've been listening.
No, so you agree with that?
Alcohol prohibition failed. That's why we legalize it. We need to
use
the same...
Yeah, but you've been busy pointing out how bad alcohol is to me for this last couple hours.
Did I ever once say alcohol should be re-illegalized?
No, I've been listening to you.
Alcohol is an example of a failed prohibition. What we did was we set up laws, we set up guidelines, we have laws against drunk driving, laws against, you know, the things that you're talking about. If you regulate things, you can control them. But guess what? If you prohibit them, who controls it? The criminals do. So what you're suggesting by keeping everything illegal is we should hand over control only to the criminals. So that way, instead of going to the store and having your kids have their ID checked, they can go to a high school campus and buy stuff without any control whatsoever. You're saying that that is safer than controls that we have today for alcohol, for tobacco, and for other substances. I think that's absurd. You have nothing more to say, clearly.